So the next session will be the beginning of the three themes, starting with the keynote on urbanization. But can I just kind of briefly remind everyone about the three themes that we have for the rest of the day? So the three themes will be the urbanization, connectivity, and governance. And here we have provided some key questions. And please do have a look at your handout for the key questions. The urbanization will be on the questions of how effective are such projects as smart cities for the future of Asia, especially Southeast Asia, and the implications for urban futures. And the connectivity panel will also be asking the questions about the Belt and Road Initiative and the implication on infrastructure, especially the implication of the infrastructure resulting from Belt and Road Initiative on the geographies of Southeast Asia. And the governance panel, governance discussion will be looking at the questions about the electoral politics in Southeast Asia in recent years, particularly asking the questions of to what extent do issues surrounding race, ethnicity, gender, class, age, and religion play a role in understanding electoral politics in the region. So the questions and various issues that came out from the first opening keynote during the ambassador's talk and also during the Q&As will all be very much the topics that are relevant to what we'll be discussing throughout the day. Without further ado, let me welcome the chair of the first urbanization keynote, Professor Tim Forsyth, who is professor in the Department of International Development and who is also the center associate. And thank you very much. I hand over the mic to Tim.
Thank you very much, everybody. So it's a great pleasure to introduce Professor Lily Kong, which is really good for me personally, because a long, long time ago, Lily and I actually did our PhDs at the same time in the same place, which was the University College London up the road, where we were all sitting in a big room together with all sorts of other PhD students working on different projects around the world. I was working on Thailand, Lily, of course, was working on Singapore, and has since gone on to create a huge reputation for herself as a cultural geographer working on green space, urban planning in Asia, but also as a high-ranking leader in the university sector in Singapore. And she is the head of the Singapore Management University and is indeed the first woman and indeed the first Singapore academic to be in the position of leading a university in Singapore. So we're extremely lucky to have Lily speaking to us today, and I'd like to welcome you to speak. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good morning to everyone, and it is indeed a delight to speak in a panel with Tim chairing. It's been a long time since we've seen each other, and it's been a long time since I've been walking these paths in LSE. As a graduate student, I used to come to the library a great deal just because a lot more Southeast Asian material was available here and, of course, in SOAS than in the UCL libraries. You've heard a great deal this morning about ASEAN working together, not least on the Smart Cities project, and this is indeed the topic of my presentation this morning. I've titled it Scaling Smartness, Deprovincializing the City, the ASEAN Smart Cities Network, and the Predictable Politics of Technocratic Regionalism. That's a mouthful, and I apologize for that, but it really is a focus on the ASCN, the ASEAN Smart Cities Network, and how it is fraught with challenges despite the rhetoric that has been developed and promulgated over the last year and more since Singapore chaired ASEAN last year. This year, as you've heard, Thailand is chairing it. And last year, when Singapore chaired it, this was one of the, if not the major initiative that was promoted. What I will do is to very briefly begin with an introduction of the topic for those who might be not entirely familiar with it. I will then go into a second section where I will talk about how smartness is to be scaled from essentially a city or a national context of Singapore to a regional context within Southeast Asia. And I will ask the question about whether such scaling is about provincializing or deprovincializing a city, and the challenges that undermine such scaling. While in that second section, I will talk about it fairly theoretically, in the third section, I will bring it specifically to the context of the ASEAN and talk about how through the ASEAN we have the emergence of what I call technocratic regionalism, which takes after what Data has called technocratic nationalism. And I'll elaborate on what I mean by technocratic regionalism in a while. And I then move on to talk about the predictable politics of technocratic regionalism before I draw some conclusions. So first, by way of introduction, Southeast Asia, as you all know, is a hugely diverse and complex area. I remember reading one of my first articles as an undergraduate taking a course on Southeast Asia and how the region was labeled the Balkans of the Orient. Just by way of the diversity, the complexity, politically, culturally, and so forth. But if you think about that diversity and complexity, there are some mega trends that are pushing it towards perhaps a point of some level of alignment, and those two mega trends have to do with urbanization and digital disruption. Just the fact that urbanization is progressing at such a rapid pace that depending on the predictions that you read about, easily two-thirds of Southeast Asia is thought to be, is predicted to be made up of the urban denizens by 2030. And even while two-thirds may not mean a great deal, if you actually look at the numbers of urban citizens that you will find, urban residents that you will find in Southeast Asia, it will actually be the most urbanized region in the world in several years' time. The second, or before I go to the second, one of the things that I think we want to recognize is that with urbanization, as you all know, comes significant challenges, whether it's infrastructural challenges, challenges to do with socioeconomic disparities and cultural challenges of multiple populations of different ethnicities, religions, class, and so forth, living cheek by jowl. The challenges that that presents is non-trivial. Alongside that urbanization megatrend is, of course, digital disruption. And for many, though not for all, that digital disruption could present a possible solution to some of the challenges that urbanization brings. And because you have these two megatrends occurring in Southeast Asia at the same time, it is perhaps of no surprise that when ASEAN met as the 10 nations with Singapore in the chair a couple of years ago, the ASEAN Smart Cities Network was promoted as an initiative for all 10 nations to work together. And it was precisely introduced to try and preempt and mitigate potentially negative effects of rapid urbanization. This ASEAN was developed with 26 pilot cities, and in a moment I'll show you a map. I'm a geographer, so I must show you a map of these 26 cities. And three strategic desired outcomes were articulated as, what ASEAN was to achieve. The first was to achieve a higher quality of life in Southeast Asia, second, a competitive economy, and thirdly, a sustainable environment. And who can quarrel with those desired outcomes as such? But if you begin to take a look at this map, immediately you will begin to see why the reality might fall behind the rhetoric. The 26 pilot cities, as you see them, with the specific countries that the cities belong to, I apologize, they're a little bit small, so I see some squints. But if you very quickly cast your eye over the slide, you will see that there will be cities that are really quite well established and some would argue are global cities, Singapore being amongst them. But you will also have cities that maybe you and I have not heard the names of. And I'm not going to name names. You can see them on the screen. And immediately when you see that disparity of the cities, the differences in the material infrastructures, the social infrastructures, leave alone the digital infrastructures, the challenge of achieving that utopic vision of a high quality of life, of a competitive economy, of sustainable environment, must necessarily be interpreted in very diverse, divergent ways. So scaling smartness, extending that smart city concept across a range of 26 cities, theoretically can lead to a deprovincialization of the city. In other words, deprovincialization in the sense that cities are embedded in larger transnational flows of capital, of ideas, of policies, and of people, and therefore removed from being provincial and taken into a transnational network. But at the same time, while the theory posits that scaling smartness can lead to a deprovincialization of cities, the reality is that scaling actually is about a reprovincialization of the city very often, and therefore complicates that process of scalar ascendancy, because when existing urban issues undermine smart solutions, you find that each city is unable to truly participate in that transnational flow of ideas and policies and technologies as such. And in effect, what does happen very often is that the scaling of smartness, this extension of smartness into a variety of cities with very divergent backgrounds to start off with, actually creates inequitable socio-spatial effects, emphasizing the vagaries of local context, ideas, and policies in a way that the theory ignores. The subject of the talk is precisely to flesh out this particular argument. So let me take a look at some of the challenges that undermine scaling in a little bit more detail. And, Graham and Marvin have talked about splintering urbanism as a manifestation of the challenge of smartness, if you will, but they haven't quite framed it that way. What they've talked about is how there is the widening socio-spatial inequalities that emerge from the inequitable provision of infrastructure they refer to as splintering urbanism. So the fact that you have digital infrastructures that are being introduced, but inequitably introduced for a variety of reasons, because of the digital divide, because of the inequitability of material infrastructure that supports the digital infrastructure, all of that actually serves to exacerbate widening socio-spatial inequalities, and they call this splintering urbanism. It's not just the inequalities per se, but the fact that it is about the inequitable provision of infrastructure that distinguishes their argument about what splintering urbanism is. And so this idea of infrastructures, the inequitable provision of infrastructures contributing to and exacerbating the socio-spatial inequalities is an idea that has also been developed by Aiwa Ong in her work on Southeast Asian cities. And she talks about the shattering effects of transnational infrastructural networks on urban environments and political conditions. Again, the focus on infrastructures, right? So these are exacerbating conditions. The fact that the networked and transnational nature of urban development actually exacerbate inequalities, the fact that embracing of smart technologies as a method of city management actually entrenches the inequalities is very much evidence of splintering urbanism as such. And unfortunately, the ASCN is a formalization of both these ideas of implementing smart urbanism at scale, but at the same time entrenching the forms of inequalities. Now, let me explain why I think this is the case. So the challenges that undermine scaling of smart cities are as follows. One, definitional challenges. Second, policy challenges. And third, antecedent challenges. First, the definitional challenge. Smartness is sometimes used as a techno-utopian term or a techno-utopian vision of urban futures. But as has been highlighted by various scholars, there is a great misunderstanding about what smart cities actually are, let alone how they can be realized. And when we talk about smart cities in many different parts of the world, and certainly in the 26 cities that we're looking at in ASEAN, there are diverse projects, from e-government to driverless vehicles to data analytics and city planning. Many people mean different things when they talk about smart cities. And where is that sort of commonality that could make the pilots in 26 cities actually benefit from one another when you're talking about vastly different things? Indeed, that sort of divergence is evident across the world. So if you think about the use of technology and smartness in different contexts, they're very different aspirations of different groups. So if you think about China, for example, and the use of smart technologies and digital disruptions in China, one of the first things that comes to mind actually is about surveillance technology, right? And the fact that, you know, whether you've crossed the road illegally, you're captured, and you get a demerit point, and you lose certain privileges or you pay more taxes. So that sort of surveillance technology is the manifestation of a certain form of smartness. But if you think about it in the context of the US with the global technology firms, of course not just the US, but certainly a lot of it is led out of the US, what you have would be smartness as a form of capital projects, of capital opportunities for capital. If you think about it, perhaps in this context, and you know it better than I do, but it is an opportunity probably for participatory governance, right? So from the range of projects, types of projects that you have, to the use to which the technologies are put, to the beneficiaries, whether it's state for surveillance possibilities or capital for profit maximization, the definitional challenge of smart cities is a very real one. And what it means is that when you have 26 cities supposedly learning from one another, all with different projects, different levels of material infrastructure to support that implementation of smartness, there's a question mark as to whether there is any sameness for progress together. So what I want to say is that the definition of a smart city is diverse. When you ask anyone what are the characteristics of a smart city, very often what you get is a proxy that is used for ascertaining smartness, and that is the establishment of digital infrastructure. What kinds of digital infrastructures have been put in place? Far less often do you get a response like the characteristics and measures of efficacy that come along with smartness. So efficacy is understandably more difficult to ascertain, more difficult to measure. It is dependent on the complex processes of socio-technical uptakes and negotiation. So you can have exactly the same technologies in exactly two different cities, but the uptakes can be very different. The responses to those technologies can be very different. And so it's very difficult to sort of measure and ascertain efficacy. And so as a proxy and as a reductionist proxy, when you say, is a city smart, we tend to say it is smart because it's got these digital infrastructures in place or not. And so the establishment of digital infrastructures very often privileges the neoliberal promises of global technology firms, while the measures of efficacy insist on focusing on problems of socioeconomic inequality in cities, because efficacy must recognize what was there in the first place and how far it actually benefits the urban residents. So in a certain sense, because of the definitional challenges, because of the assessment challenges of efficacy, we get the reductionistic definitions of smart cities, and what you define is what you get. What you define is what you get. So when you say, are we on the trajectory of smart city development? If the infrastructures are there, the answer is yes, this is a city on its path towards smartness, but actually, in reality, in efficacy terms, there are major question marks. Now let me turn to the policy challenges. Policy challenges arise because local urban policy, or good local urban policy, must necessarily be rooted in local conditions. But very often, urban policies are taken up in global discourses and global networks of ideas and expectations. And so when we talk about global city, a smart city, the language of it, the technologies of it, is taken up into the global discourses and the global technologies and the global provisions of technologies through technology firms and so forth. And yet, the local urban policy that is truly effective needs to address some pre-existing socio-spatial divisions and inequalities. If at all possible, to actually try not to create new inequalities. But the reality is that very often, getting a bit nervous. Are you showing me the sign that says 1 minute? Oh, phew, okay. The reality is that there is this schism between the global discourses and the local urban policies that actually need to be put in place, and that divergence comes about because of three factors. I would suggest that they come about because of three factors. One is power relations. Two is the speed at which policies are being imported and implemented. And three, back to the question of efficacy. Now, power. Very often, network spaces are unevenly distributed, and I'm quoting data here. Network spaces are unevenly distributed and coincide with elite and middle-class access. Right? So who has access to these technologies? Who can have access to the smartphones, for example, in certain societies, as opposed to your 2G phones, right? And that is determined in large part by power relations, power very often anchored in access to finance, capital, and resources. And so what happens, as we all know, is the digital divide that then mirrors and indeed exacerbates existing socioeconomic inequalities. So power relations and inequalities that are inherent to smart city discourses are actually what get scaled up when smartness is a scaling up project. Secondly, the speed of policy transfer. Very often, many cities, and it's not confined to smartness or smart cities, it is reminiscent of many other projects in creative cities and eco-cities and so forth, where you get a certain idea, it gets taken up in global discourse, it gets imported into policy communities, and then suddenly you have the panacea for cities. And the speed at which these policies are then to be implemented is very, very often what is problematic, and it is no different in this case of smart cities. The speed of policy transfer, because it is so much easier to import policies that are perceived to have been efficacious in some other context. It is faster, it is proven effective somewhere else, and safer than to try to create a policy ex novo. So some of the literature supports this idea that speed is actually problematic, because we're not taking time to think about how policies cannot simply import homogeneity. The local conditions need to be absolutely recognized and addressed. And all of this results in the lack of efficacy, which then becomes a vicious cycle. And that local context, the importance of recognizing the local context that I spoke about a little bit earlier, is precisely this antecedent challenge, that nearly all cities, unless you are a Canberra or a Brasilia that was started from scratch, nearly all cities have antecedents. Nearly all cities have a history, a culture, a heritage, and an existing set of challenges. And so in scaling up smart cities, the antecedents are very often ignored. In fact, in Cambodia, one of the solutions is to say it's too challenging to try and import some of these policies into Phnom Penh, let's set up a new city. But then how do you address the existing challenges in Phnom Penh, which was the point in the first place? So smart cities are implicated in these transnational and global networks and ideas, and whilst globality is based on the homogenizing logics of intercity comparison, competitiveness and conformity, an understanding of locality reveals the heterogeneous complexity of urban formations. Globality is aspirational. It is about envisioning the future. Locality, I would say, is historical, and it is about understanding how past processes have come to shape how cities are defined in the present. And therein lies the challenge between globality and locality. Wig is even more harsh in his, even harsher in his critique, where he says, and I quote, "Techno-utopian smart city solutions present a distraction from actually addressing the long-standing urban inequalities these policies are intended to fix." And so this is the antecedent challenge. Now let me move, although I've kind of woven in a little bit about the ASEAN Smart Cities Network, let me now focus specifically on the ASCN and the emergence of technocratic regionalism. Now, just as a reminder, I mentioned that I developed this idea of technocratic regionalism borrowing from Dutta's idea of technocratic nationalism. And of course, it's not Dutta's alone. Other people have, in various ways, also engaged this concept. And this is a way of understanding how technology affects a nation for the better, right? So it's a techno-utopia. Technology is the solution. It is the solve. It makes a nation better. It promotes growth, sustainability, prosperity, providing a better life, greater connectedness, a stronger national identity, etc. It's not a direct quote, but a summary of what Dutta calls technocratic nationalism. I extend that to a technocratic regionalism through a project like the ASCN because it extends or scales the idea or the ideal to a regional level. And ASCN's three stated objectives, if I might elaborate, and they are largely economic and political ones here, to promote cooperation, right? Bringing the region together, working together for the betterment of the region. It is supposed to develop commercially viable projects together with private sector solution providers, right? Again, an economically oriented aim of ASCN. And to facilitate, thirdly, collaboration with ASEAN's external partners. So bringing in partners, Japan, US, etc., into the region to work together as such. Now, these are largely economic and political aims. Just keep at the back of your mind the social goals of improving the lives of people for a moment. But in much of the literature, you get this spiel about cooperation, collaboration, partnerships, with technology firms, with other countries, and so forth. Now, one might ask the question, why would Singapore promote ASCN and technocratic regionalism? There are two ideas that I would posit, and some of this comes through an analysis of the speeches, the documents that have been put out, and the two ideas are Singapore as hub, and secondly, promoting investment and entrepreneurial urban governance into the region. Singapore has help. This is really very much about maintaining, according to Tranoz and Gertner, to maintain Singapore's strong global position. And given its rather limited market size, Singapore has all of some 6 million people right now, given the very limited market size, it is necessary not only to continue investing in ICT per se, but also to further reinforce the hub roles that Singapore performs, that it can do things for the region as a hub, bring technologies to the region as a hub. So ASEAN formalizes the market for Singapore design smart solutions. Of course, it is also about bringing technologies from elsewhere, but given Singapore's ambitions for the very nascent startup tech sector, having this, 5 minutes left, okay, having this ASCN is a way of developing a market for Singapore design smart solutions, allowing tech startups to scale up in the region in the way it can't in a market size of 6 million. Secondly, it's also about promoting investment and entrepreneurial urban governance into Southeast Asia. It attracts private and public sector investment into the region, catalyzes bankable projects with the private sector, and secure funding and support from ASEAN's external partners. And all of this helps to grow the region that can also benefit Singapore simultaneously. Now, in theory, aside from all these economic and political goals that I've spoken about, the ASEAN is also, very importantly, designed to support the social goals within ASEAN. It is to be people-oriented, people-centered solutions, and it is intended to improve livability. But the question I ask is, what is the empirical evidence of that? But granted, I want to make a very big caveat, ASEAN is very, very nascent. It's into its second year, and so the jury is out. But at this point in time, to the extent that I am able to analyze some of it, I'd like to share some of the empirical evidences. And this is what leads me to the third or fourth part of my talk, which is about the predictable politics of technocratic regionalism. Now, the challenges that could limit the ASEAN's success within Southeast Asia, within ASEAN, are as follows. First, divergent infrastructural developments in the region. Second, vertical and horizontal integration, or rather non-integration. Thirdly, the need to reconcile informal spaces of the city that is so evident in so many Southeast Asian cities with a smart technology or smart technologies that actually work with formal plans rather than informality, right? Now, these three challenges are based on very nascent observations in the region, but a lot of it is also drawn from observations of other implementations of smart city projects in other parts of the world. So drawn from past smart city experiments, from nascent empirical insights, and to that extent, I would forgive myself for not being too speculative and in actuality also argue that some of these challenges are actually not unpredictable. Right? So hence the title of this section, The Predictable Politics, as such. And yes, because they are very often, these challenges are very often implicated in power relations, hence the notion of politics. So let me just begin by talking about divergent infrastructural developments. And if I have no time to elaborate, just take a look at what is on the screen. I do have no time to elaborate. I only have 2 minutes left. But just take a look at what's on the screen. Efficient bus timetables and smart traffic lights. And this is what comes with smart cities, right? Efficient bus timetables and smart traffic lights. But they are no substitute for wider roads and fewer potholes. Okay? And this is what I mean by divergent infrastructural developments. You can have the best digital infrastructures, but if your material infrastructures are lagging behind, your digital infrastructures are not going to make a jot of difference to the lives of the individuals. Right? And I elaborate on that, but I'm going to skip the slide because I have 2 minutes left. Second, vertical and horizontal non-integration. What do I mean by vertical integration? By that, I mean the different levels of decision-making in many countries. Singapore, arguably, is probably one of the few exceptions where, you know, you don't have the city government, the national government, regional forces at play. And so in Singapore, what has been doable is very much more challenged, much more challenging to implement in the other Southeast Asian cities, right? So that vertical integration, the need for different layers of government to be aligned, is a challenge that Singapore does not have experience in. Second, horizontal integration, and this is about the need for different governing bodies within the same layer to align. But it's also for public and private sector stakeholders to align. And in effect, when they are not aligned, what you have are opportunities for profiteering and exploitation. When your regulatory frameworks are not in place, for example, and large-scale smart city projects are introduced and financed and managed by private sector companies, the possibilities for profiteering emerge, right? So I'm happy to speak to this if there is time during Q&A, but the point I'm trying to make is that the vertical and horizontal integration is absolutely necessary if the smart cities are going projects are to succeed. Thirdly, smart urbanism brings about two things. One, privatization of cities, because smart urbanism depends on corporates, the corporate sector, to bring their technologies. And therefore, what they're doing is they privatize city systems. Okay? And at the same time, what they do, what smart urbanism does, is to formalize city spaces, turning the informal quotidian experiences into formal existences that are identified, tracked, and monitored. Right? So when you're living in a slum and squatter settlement, you're not on some register necessarily. You're not tracked. Your use of electricity is not part of that grid where you're monitored and tracked and so forth. Right? Whereas in making a city smart, you actually need to have your data completely accurate and in place for delivery of services and for those services to be efficacious. And so what smart urbanism does is to privatize cities and formalize cities. And privatization is problematic to the extent that it introduces speed and with speed homogenization. This links back to what I was saying earlier about speedy policy transfers. What privatization does is that it must scale up, it must expand, because that's the only way that you're actually going to be profitable. It's no point introducing one single technology into one place and not have it scaled up into other cities in the country, because you're not going to make your profits. So what privatization does is it homogenizes and it gives opportunity to profit-making, right? And there is nothing wrong necessarily in profit-making per se if you are addressing the challenges that the city faces. But if you are bringing the private capital and their technologies into a city at speed, you're not homogenizing, therefore you're not tailoring to the needs of the city. In terms of formalization, just to give you some examples, drones are used to map the city in Mandalay, and therefore you have new data of where all the buildings are, including those informal dwellings. And what it means, there's a use implication here, there are tax implications. The state can begin to formally tax people who are formerly under the radar. Another example, GPS trackers on garbage trucks, also in Mandalay. The idea is that you want the garbage trucks to follow the routines, make sure that they're collecting the garbage so that the cities become clean. But you know what? Your garbage truck drivers are resisting that. They're pouring water over the GPS systems so that they cannot be tracked because they want their lives to be what their lives are, right? So there are different ways of formalizing the city, but resistances to that formalization of the city. I'm going to skip some of this, and I'll come to my conclusion. I have a very generous 1 minute left. I'm sure it's less than that, but thank you for giving me the minute nonetheless. Just thinking about it intellectually as an academic word, these issues to do with smart cities, for me, are implicated in the broader debates in urban studies, not limited to smart cities. They're implicated in and reflective of debates around definitional ambiguities. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about eco-cities or creative cities or smart cities. Embroiled in all of that is a homogenizing tendency through global discourse that does not recognize local conditions sufficiently, if at all. And the policy mobility that comes along with these global discourses is something that we see in other urban studies projects as well, right? All the debates in policy mobility studies, as well as in scalar politics. So while I have focused on smart cities and the ASCN, et cetera, I would suggest that this particular study actually takes us into larger urban debates in academia. Secondly, scaling smartness. Cities are not passive backdrops for digital technologies. This has been the thrust of what I've been trying to say in the last 25 minutes or so, and the logics of scale can serve to deny the city of its agency. For a regional smart cities network to have a chance of success, this is not just my work. I have a co-author whom I should have introduced at the beginning. Orlando Woods is a colleague at the Singapore Management University, and we've been talking through some of these things. So for a regional smart cities network to have a chance of success, we suggest two things. One, slow. Counterintuitive in the world of capital movements, moving across the globe at breakneck speed, because the faster you go, the greater the profits, the sooner. But to minimize the potentially negative effects that come with speed, homogenization, neglect of local conditions, socio-material infrastructure lagging behind the digital infrastructures that I talked about earlier, remember the bus timetables versus the potholes in the roads. Smart solutions are not quick fixes to systemic problems. They are a catalyzing glue that is only as effective as the policy regime and material environment within which it is deployed. Second, small. Again, counterintuitive to the major capital projects of smart cities, but it is important for small-scale projects to be put in place because they minimize the potentially negative effects of transformation. Transformation is a nice word, a big word. You're transforming people's lives, but actually that's extremely disruptive as well. And to go small means that we recognize the value of small incremental improvements rather than major transformations that are out of sync with the material conditions of the city in question. ASCN is at a scale of smartness hitherto unattempted. The job of the academy, and I feel strongly about this, for us as academics, or some of us as academics, it's important, I think, that we moderate some of the positivist underpinnings of many smart city policies, and we insistently call for a restoration of local agency to the analysis. Thank you very much for your patience.
Lily, would you like to join me up here? Thank you very much, Lily. That was a fascinating talk from somebody who is really in the front line of urbanization and policy in Southeast Asia. Do we have any questions? Okay, I'm seeing a few questions, so I'm going to take you first. Thank you.
Hi there. My name is Catherine. Hello. I had a question about the slide in which you talked about profiteering and exploitation. As a Cambodia specialist, I'm really keen to learn a bit more about what you've learned about the Cambodia case and maybe delve a bit deeper into this question of potentially corruption. I don't know, but I'd be really interested to hear more. Thank you.
Thank you. Perhaps we could take a couple of...
Yeah, we'll take a couple of questions. I think there's one at the back from... Yes, yeah, that one there. Thank you.
Hello, hi. Thank you so much for the talk. I was wondering about the slide you talked about, the possibility of creating new inequalities and this notion of cities. So I'm wondering about this urban-rural kind of divide where we're prioritizing cities. Are there any implications for the rural areas around it or the peri-urban regions? And for example, Singapore is like big Sejori movement in the 1970s and 80s, and now you have problems in Batam and not sure what's happening about there. Or like in Thailand where 30% of GDP is still agricultural. So I'm wondering if there are kind of measures, so not just to slow down and make it smaller to minimize the effects, but actually things that combat these kind of new inequalities that might be included. Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Why don't you answer those two, and then we'll...
Okay. So the question on Cambodia, thank you, Catherine, very nice to meet you. I can't claim to be an expert on Cambodia, and I haven't actually done, as you could see, a lot of it was, just looking across the countries as opposed to diving deep. But in the Cambodia situation, yes, the attraction of these projects is sometimes partly about the opportunities for corruption. When a project is brought in to a city at very low prices, a technology is brought into a city at very low prices, or sometimes given gratis. Try out this technology, we're going to give it to you free, and it's a global technology firm that's offering that. The hope behind that for the firm, for the technology company, is that there is demonstration effect. There is a positive demonstration effect that something good derives out of this, and therefore they can then sell their products to other cities and scale up as such. And so it is about a market entry strategy. The challenge with that is that very often, because of corruption issues, you do get outcomes that are exaggerated. The positive outcomes are, the so-called positive outcomes are exaggerated. They're not necessarily real measures of efficacy, but the rhetoric runs ahead of it, because if these technology firms then are able to promote and distribute their technologies to other cities within the country, or indeed scale up within that same city, there is something to be gained. And so what happens is there is a talking up of the benefits of these technologies purportedly from implementation experience, when in fact what all it does is it contributes to the rhetoric still more rather than the reality of improving lives. So there is some of that that is happening not just in Cambodia but in other parts of Southeast Asia. The new inequalities and the implications for rural areas, absolutely. The fact that urbanization is progressing at the speed that it is in Southeast Asia does not suggest that the rural areas are left behind necessarily. In fact, you get a whole lot more, I think, peri-urbanization and so forth. So the inequalities that we're talking about in the context of cities is actually exacerbated as the spread occurs. And so those inequalities that you would see confined to the cities, you begin to see extending to the peri-urban areas and so forth. And then, of course, the truly left behind will find that that inequality between them and the other two-thirds and the two-thirds plus. I don't know that there have been... but I haven't actually looked. I don't know if there have been actually studies to specifically track and measure and comment, but it's not something that I've looked into, so I won't say that there aren't. The apologies.
Second question. Have you done both questions? Yeah, okay, that's good. I actually had a couple of people, so I had you and go at the back.
Richard Griffiths from Biden University. I wanted to ask, how was the ASEAN selection of cities made up? Because the list went very quickly, but in Vietnam you've got about the three largest cities, but the collection for Thailand included Phuket and leaves out Chiang Mai, and the cities are very different sizes, so was there a collective criteria? And can I hang on a little small one? Do you have a benchmark example where you say, wow, that went well in a middle-income country? Is there a successful smart city experiment that you could aspire to within ASEAN?
And we'll take the second question at the back. And we are running out of time, so I'm hoping fast responses. We might be able to squeeze in one more question, but this might possibly be it.
Thank you. Matthew Phillips, UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office. I just wondered if you might be able to maybe elaborate a little bit more on agency and actually precisely what you mean by that. So you speak a lot about this sort of the difference between global discourse and the need to kind of understand the local conditions. But I also think there's a sort of national discourse and a local discourse there which perhaps needs to be elaborated on. And the ability and the interest of the Smart Cities Network to account for, but also understand, work with the local administrations, and even deal with some of the political issues that are obviously behind some of the inequalities that exist locally. I wondered, for example, are cities represented by local representatives at the network, or is it just through national elites?
Thank you. So those are all very good questions. On the selection criteria, a lot of it was left to the individual cities, and I'm starting a project that actually looks at the making of the ASCN. So some of this is very preliminary work that went into writing my grant application. So the short answer to it was a lot of it was left to the countries in question, and how they selected is a subject of interrogation, of analysis that I will be doing, and I'm sorry I can't answer that question now. As to whether there are aspirational benchmarks, I am reminded of the work that has emerged on Singapore as model. People like Chua Bing Huat have written about that and so forth, and it's written in as a critique, not as a flag waiver, if I might put it that way. The trouble with that is, I mean, Singapore is probably further along this journey than many other cities in Southeast Asia. The trouble with that is, exactly as I've said earlier, the conditions in Singapore are vastly different. And, you know, the fact that we have one layer of government and you don't have to navigate between the different levels that the gentleman at the back was talking about, it's unique. So while there is a certain level of success, and even that is a very mitigated level of success within the context of Singapore, it is so different that I'm not sure how useful it is as an aspirational benchmark for the other cities. And just on the question of agency and what I mean by it, you made a very good point about the fact that local agency may mean one thing, and national level discourse versus global level discourse is something else. And in my speed rush, I've conflated them. But really, they should be teased apart in analysis, because there is a national level discourse about a country aspiring towards a vision of modernity and the future and progress and all those sorts of terms. But at the same time, local agency is very much about, at the city level, the city government and the challenges that it faces. And yet, at a still more granular level of analysis, it is about the individual and the agency of the local individual in living out his or her life in the midst of all these changes. So the scalar politics of ASCN, which is at a national regional level, is actually also played out in a different level of scalar politics between national, city, and individual as such. And that, again, is something that requires further analysis. I hope I get the grant so that I can do this study.
I think that really will have to be it. Thank you for anybody who wants to ask a question. I'm afraid we're just out of time. So I'd like to thank Lily, and to ask everybody else to thank Lily for an excellent scholarly discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.